The following program is paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now presented by Little John Financial Services. It's David Little John with True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, you know what that means. It is time for the True Wealth Radio Show on this, the best Tuesday you've had all week.
And maybe the best radio show we're going to have all month.
Wow.
I know, we're
mind
setting the bar high.
Blown. Yeah. Right? Hey, welcome in studio with me today, of course.
Matt Dixon.
And we are, so I am really actually very excited about today's show. So behind the scenes, sometimes I sort of, it's a term of endearment when I say this, right? But for weird ways that he doesn't know, I refer to Matt as the kid.
Yeah.
Now, the reason for that is because there was a really terrible B-movie one time that was a remake of the first-person shooter game Doom, and one of the characters in it was called the kid. Mm. And, you know, I just thought it was hilarious because he looked around and he was so annoyed because it's like a Marine, you know, that shows up and it's like, you know, all these guys with these cool nicknames and one of them's the kid. And you're like, really?
So, hey, that's the one you don't want to mess with, right? Billy the Kid. Anytime there's a word kid in there, you got
to. Well, I love it because Matt also brings a whole different perspective. If there's one thing that we have established, right? You and I don't problem solve the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is actually really important because when we look at investment analysis or we're working on a financial planning solution with somebody, coming at it from different perspectives is really valuable. So why all the setup today? It was Matt that came up with the idea for today's show. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about what inspired this and what motivated this today.
Yeah, I mean, when I was thinking about what type of radio show do we want to do, I think something that's been on my mind a lot is kind of the idea of what is a narrow-minded investor, right?
And so, why were you asking that question, you think?
You know, it kind of came out of nowhere, to be honest. I
thought it was because we had our investment committee meeting this morning, and he's probably looking at his, you know, boss going, well, I wonder.
Yeah, no, not that. Not that. But, you know, I asked myself kind of, you know, what are some of the areas where maybe people are making mistakes, even like really good investors?
Oh, yeah.
Where are the mistakes at?
Blind spots, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Blind spots was one of them. And then some of the stuff that we don't necessarily think about very often.
And all right. So you use the term narrow-minded.
Yeah.
That's kind of specific in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because
a lot of people just have like the baseline assumptions of, you know, have a blended portfolio and everything will be fine, right? Like,
okay,
there's that assumption. And then some people believe that they can force their way into better results, right? Like, if I just muscle this thing hard enough, or if I do enough research, I'm going to somehow outsmart everything.
My favorite is like, well, I own something, and so while I own it, I'm going to just keep researching it. Like, well, that's not action either,
right?
By the way, that's like, I'm learning more about the thing that I already made the decision on.
Right.
Right. So the research is not really affecting your decision any longer.
Yeah. And then, you know, you have the person that only looks at the return on their investment. Right. And that is a big piece of it, but it's not always all of it. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think today's show is trying to figure out how do we become a little bit more dynamic and a little bit more wise when it comes to assessing an opportunity.
So I have to go, right? Like, you have to do something like that because you can't, like, you know, do a beard stroke or an eyebrow raise or something on the radio. So I'll just be like, go on.
Yeah. So one of the, should we jump into it and just kind of start talking about this?
So, you know, I wanted the frame up for our listeners because this is something, when Matt shared this with me, I'm just immediately like, this is a great show, right? It's a great show because so many people, they know parts of investing. And like, I think I'm just as guilty as anybody else, right? The advantage that, you know, we have as pros is we do this day in and day out, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we get more opportunities to make the mistakes.
Right.
The good news is if you are learning from your mistakes, then you make fewer of the same mistakes over and over again. We get to make all new mistakes.
Yes.
Right? But it does create a great backdrop for education. And so after 25 years, I have touched the hot stove a few times and learned some painful lessons. And there are still lessons to be learned. And there are lessons, thankfully, I've learned from other people, too. I haven't always touched the hot stove. Yay.
Yeah.
So was there anything that initially like stands out in your mind where you go, honestly, this is the thing?
I think there's a really big one. And it's this idea of what are you constrained by? And I think a lot of people move into this investment land and they're like, well, the opportunities are unlimited. It's endless opportunity. And there are things that I think we have to think about that will shape how we invest. And it comes down to some different variables, right? Like, what are you constrained by? Age, for example, right? Okay. Like, if you only have 3 years to be invested before you've got to spend all your money, like, that is going to change how you invest compared to someone who has 60 years to be an investor. Right. Okay. And so that's one where I think a lot of people, they don't understand it. And in our industry, we call it time horizon. Right. Like, how long do you have to be in the game or to be an investor?
Okay.
Because that really can change things. So maybe it's time. Right.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing it could be is how much money do you have available to invest? How much capital do you have on hand? Because if you've got a really long time and a lot of money, that might be a real different situation than someone who has a lot of time and not very much money. It changes where you might be investing and how you're investing.
Yes.
So how much capital do you have? And then just like even getting down to the nitty gritty, like what are some of your like personal beliefs and rules in investing? Because sometimes, you know, someone might have something that like just a belief structure that changes their investment portfolio too, right? And so I think there's just
or their behavior around the investment, certainly.
Yeah. And so there's so many different ways that people are kind of constrained by the situations or where they're at in their life. And I think if you're able to be in a place where you can recognize those, I think that really can help you change what your objective is.
Yeah. So I kind of I was thinking of synonyms for what you said, like other ways. So you said there are
time.
Well, so I guess I think of parameters.
Yeah.
Right? So maybe there's parameters to your investments. Rules might be another. Restrictions was one way. But so there's these different elements for each investor that are going to affect how and what you get to invest in to accomplish the mission.
Right.
Right. And so, yeah, time is a huge one, of course, because you know, it's going to that is a parameter that is significant mostly for risk management. Right.
Right.
And the reality is if you only have one day, but you could pick an investment that could go up 10,000% overnight, then you could still do great.
Right.
Right. And if you know that one, see me after class. Right. And I don't know it. So but yeah, if you could find an investment that could be leveraged 10,000 to 1 and you knew you'd hit a home run out of the park with it, then yeah, you put everything there and go for it.
Yeah.
I just, you know, don't know where to find a leprechaun riding a unicorn carrying two pots of gold.
One of the constraints that I didn't even put on my list is your appetite for volatility, right? Because some people, they want to be aggressive when they invest. Yeah.
Can I pause for just a second?
Yeah.
Like you said something that's really important. Volatility is probably like the word risk, I've talked on the show over the years about like risk is this four-letter word that has a lot of different meanings.
Mm-hmm.
So volatility is one of those.
Right.
It's that willingness to endure the market swings up and down, the value changes, right? If you invest in Tesla, then right now you're 50% off of your highs that you experienced in December.
And some people are completely okay with that. And then there are some people that would be sweating bullets
losing their
in
mind.
The hospital, right? Like, oh my gosh. And so that is a constraint. How much can you handle? And a lot of people try and tell themselves, you know, because they want the higher return, oh, I can handle the volatility.
Yeah.
But then when the volatility hits, they're like, what happened? So I think one of the big pieces is actually knowing yourself and what you're okay with. Like, how are you going to be able to sleep at night?
Yeah, and it's funny because constraint to me seems like something that's forced upon oneself. you could select the level of volatility that you're willing to endure. The issue is, are you honest with yourself about your selection?
Exactly.
I think that's the real question that you're kind of hinting at. It's like, oh yeah, I've got a high risk tolerance until I don't,
mm-hmm.
right? Until I freak out. Then you realize, no, you don't. Like, you're freaking out.
Yeah.
You know, if you freak out, then I have news for you. You actually don't have a high risk tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe it's too late, so you ride it out anyway. And then when you feel better later, you're like, oh, everything was fine. But it wasn't fine. You were freaking out.
I think that's one of the things that people need to look for when they're interviewing advisors, mm-hmm. right? Like, if you're trying to find someone, I think that's something you should really look for is, you know, when we're talking, are you trying to assess, you know, my comfort level? Because sometimes you'll get someone that just wants to sell you a product or just get you in the door and show you how great they are. But at the end of the day, it's like you really need someone who is going to be looking at where are you comfortable and then advocating for you to be in the right place based on that.
Well, I guess the question is, yeah, are you going in somewhere where they're going to sell you their way of doing it mm-hmm. and you have to be okay with that?
Right.
Or are you going somewhere where they're going to build something to what you're okay with?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, who moves, right?
Yeah.
Do they move the strategy to you, or do you have to move to the strategy?
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, the advisor might say, hey, you know, based on your circumstances mm-hmm. and the fact that maybe you're a little bit behind based on what you need to make it, maybe we need to bump the risk up a little bit.
Or maybe if it's not circumstance, well, I mean, the circumstances,
right.
I think part of it, sometimes it's expectation management.
Right.
Like, oh, you came in expecting this kind of thing, and the parameters that you set were unrealistic. We need to either have a discussion about how to reframe this, or we've actually turned clients away. I have turned potential clients away before because we had a real misalignment of expectations. They thought that I should be able to deliver way more than I thought that I could comfortably deliver. And they showed me some, you know, well, no, look, I see this investment here. It's done this, that, and the other thing. And I saw this ad that does this. So that's what I want. And I'm like, well, you're going to need to go there. Because I can't guarantee that, and I don't want to be in a position where you're going to later on blame me for the decision that you're making right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
that's a big piece.
Yeah, it is. So it's really an interesting one because, you know, when I look at what you wrote, so the power of constraints, right? It does work both ways, though. Constraints
it does.
Can also be really good.
Yes, because
right?
It can lead you to a higher conviction level where you're like, no, I'm convicted. This is what, you know, I really believe in, and I'm going to be able to hold this line even when things are volatile and things are dicey.
Yeah. So what I want to do is for all of you listening, wondering like when might constraints be good or what might be good constraints, right? Let's talk about that. I'm looking at the clock. We're running a little bit long on this first segment. So we'll do this. Let's jump and grab a break. And then when we come back, again, for all of you guys that are kind of wondering constraints, what does that mean? What should I, is that for me? If so, what does that look like? We're going to unpack some of that, but first these really important profits, you know, that's what we had to do on the radio. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
You got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM, 1240 KQEN.
Hi, this is Roger.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Matt Dixon.
All right, remember, gang, you can grab a podcast to get caught up. Today, we've got an interesting one all about really the ways that investors sometimes get a little too myopic, too narrow-minded in their approach, and it can trigger mistakes and whatnot. You talked mm-hmm. to me a little bit about the concept of constraints.
Yeah.
Right? And first it was some constraints that an investor doesn't necessarily voluntarily set, right? Mm-hmm. How much money are you working with? How much time do you have until you need to use the money? I mean, some of those things are kind of almost outside of your control. Right.
Right.
I mean, you can control how much money you have to a certain extent, but it's, you know, when it's time to get started, it's a snapshot in time. Right. We can't print more. So you got what you got. But there are other constraints that one could sort of set upon themselves. Right. Rules of engagement. Put the fence around your homestead, if you will. What are some things that you think investors should consider if they were going to
like
otherwise
do it themselves.
Yeah, like put their own boundaries in place.
Yeah, I mean, one of the big ones I personally have is to purchase things that I understand, right? Like, I don't understand cryptocurrency. Like, I've tried, I've dug into it. I don't really get it, and I don't understand the...
Well, I can explain it. It's my favorite.
Go
ready
for
the snarky explanation?
Do it.
It's the bigger fool asset.
Just whoever's willing to buy it the next time around.
Yeah, yeah, you can buy it, and as long as there's a bigger fool than you that will buy it from you later for more, you're good.
Yeah.
Right? And that's the problem with assets that are a bubble. Because when I tell people, hey, show me what cryptocurrency does. And they're like, well, they tell me what it is, not what
but
it does.
But does. I have a hard time with that.
Right?
So
it's like, oh, well, it's this digital asset and it's outside of the government's control. Mm-hmm. And it's a store of value and they're not printing more. So it's going to go up as they print other money. And I go, okay. But so, like, gold is a tangible commodity. And when somebody says, well, should you invest in gold? I said, but what does gold do?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And the answer is very limited. It has jewelry application and some industrial and scientific application for, like, conductors and stuff like that. But mostly, it's scarce. That's what it does.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because it's scarce and limited, it became a proxy to represent and store the value of wealth, right? And throughout history, other people have had that. It literally, like clams, beads, other, you know, carvings, weird stuff. And it's like, okay.
I love that you just compared gold to clams and beads.
I'm just saying, right? And so what was the problem with clams? It was easier to counterfeit, right? So gold was hard to counterfeit. So it became a suitable replacement for something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But cryptocurrency, it's like, okay, so it's hard to counterfeit. What does it do? Just like gold, what does it do?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, it attracts people that think that something that was created in the digital ethos is valuable. And what they cite is, well, here's what it does. It can be exchanged freely between people without the need for exchange, without any kind of government regulation.
Mm.
Okay. So without government regulation is kind of, it's a little dark, but black market.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, hey, I have something that I can keep off the radar that's finite in supply that I can trade in the black market somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
And you go, okay, right?
Yep.
It's a good idea until it isn't. And then when I talk about Dutch tulip bulbs, people are like, I don't know what you're talking about. So go look up, go do a Google search or a, you know, ChatGPT search on the Dutch tulip bubble of the late 1500s.
That's the perfect one for crypto, right?
Right, and then explain to me why Bitcoin is going to be the best thing ever.
Right, so buy things that you understand.
Yeah.
And if you can't understand it, it's probably a good reason to either do more research or don't buy it, pass, until you understand it better.
Right. Right.
And then that leads me into the next one, which is buy stuff that you believe in long term, right? Like, if it's a company that you love and you're like, you know what, I really see this being a viable company for years to come, it's probably a good sign that you can invest in it if you really believe in it long term. Now, does it mean you should invest? No. But it's a good indicator that, like, you might be okay to explore this. Like, yeah. For me, like,
can
I look
ask,
at...
What's long term to you?
A year or two.
All right, see... Also important to know.
Yeah.
Because long term to me, I'm like, buy something you could die with. And
right.
And then I go, but there are a lot of companies that go
well,
through
life cycles.
Well,
we're going to get into that.
Yeah.
We're going to
we
get
are,
into that
are.
Later in the show. But like, so for example, like tobacco stocks, right? I look at tobacco and I'm like, the usage seems like it's going down and down and down, right? And then mm-hmm. It's regulated and it's being taxed heavier and heavier. And I'm like, I don't believe in that long term. I don't think that trend looks good.
Yeah.
And so even
and
if the stock
is 1 to 2 years.
Yeah.
Like, it could be anything in 1 to 2 years. But the bigger one, yeah, I don't believe in it for lots of reasons. I agree with you.
Right. And so I look at that and I'm like, even if it's really discounted today, I don't even want to touch that stove.
Yep.
So, and then the other big one to me is not chasing. Chase. People want to look at something and they're like, hey, this thing ran up a bunch. We should jump in on it. And it's like, by the time it ran,
I used to joke about it being the shoeshine guy, but that seems disrespectful to shoeshine guys. or the Uber driver, which I also don't mean to be disrespectful for the Uber driver. But the point was, if you're getting stock advice from just a layman on the street, it's like, well, they're no longer experts that are giving you the advice. It's so popular, so pervasive that it's showing up all over the place. I'm like, yeah, you done missed it.
Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah, it's not a secret anymore. You're not sneaking up on this thing and getting a good value. Everybody knows.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, you are just jumping on the bandwagon is what you're doing. And that's back to the bigger fool theory at that point.
Right. Yes. And that's going to, later on in the show, one of the last things I want to talk about is this idea of second level thinking. And this whole idea of not chasing is going to segue into that pretty well. But you're going to have to stick around to the end of the show to catch that idea, because it's a big one. It's a really big idea.
I'm going to stick around because I'm not even sure where he's going yet. It's kay. Very exciting.
Remember, we mentioned it. So, but that's a big one for me. What about you, David? Is there anything that you want to kind of touch on before we kind of jump into the next segment here?
Well, on constraints and beliefs. You know, I think I kind of hinted at it in the first segment, this idea of where are your expectations, and you need to kind of be grounded in realistic expectations.
Yeah, realistic. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And realistic is the biggie, right? Mm-hmm. I have had folks that show up and they say things like, well, let me give you an example. Maybe you're trolling around the internet somewhere and you've been doing stock research and you start seeing these ads that say, you know, this, you know, former Wall Street hedge fund manager the code and is, you know, willing to let you buy the newsletter and you know, you're going to become rich, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, take these penny stocks and make gazillions of dollars. And they say, you know, make, you know, 1,074% returns in the last 9 months. Look at the statement to prove it, right? And here's the question I always have to ask somebody is, so if somebody out there has cracked the code to the market that nobody else has cracked, and they are making tons of money, what incentive do they have to share it with you and otherwise dilute or eliminate the hack that they created? If they can print money, why would they need to sell anything to you to make money?
Or they just bought the asset, right? And then they're
that's the biggest one is the pump and dump scheme.
Yeah.
They bought it. Now they need to generate interest so that they can get an exit.
Yeah, they found some penny stock that is like super thinly traded, trades under $1 million a day. And it's like, well, if you can talk 100 people to each investing $10,000 into this thing.
Yeah, and it rockets up in value, and then you make your exit on the money they're putting in, right?
Exactly.
And they're the ones, we'll call these bag holders, right? They're the ones left holding the bag. There's nothing in it, though.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that idea that somebody would turn over the keys to the mystery black box, make you infinity money, and it's just, you just can't go wrong. Like, that just can't make intuitive sense ever.
Mm-hmm.
And so you look at it and go, okay, well, if historical market returns are somewhere between 8 and 12% per year, and you have to be willing to tolerate volatility and so forth, and then somebody thinks, and this was going on, by the way, 5 years ago, when everybody's like, well, I bought Tesla, and it doubled my money this year.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a great investor.
Right.
I owned 100% of my assets were in Tesla, and I'm just going to hang on to this thing until it goes to infinity.
Ooh, that's a perfect segue into the next segment. I bought this thing and I held it and it's just going to go to infinity. I want to talk about that in detail.
Yeah. So this one, I'm going to set it up a little bit, but I'm not going to do it for this segment either. The setup is that we all have biases we bring to the table.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you're not familiar with the term bias, right? It's this idea that you have your own prejudgment about something. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is sometimes it's wrong. Right? It may be normal. This is a real hard concept to grasp too. Sometimes the normal thing is the wrong thing, but everybody does it. So it feels like it's right because it's normal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And like sometimes you just being normal, you do the math wrong.
Yeah.
I have a really simple example of normal but wrong.
Ooh.
And people will argue with me about it.
I want to argue. Let's do this.
Of course you do. But I will make you wait until after.
Do I get to be the one arguing the other end of this?
You could try.
Okay, let's do it.
So when we come back, Matt will try to argue how normal is right, and I will try to argue why normal is not. Okay. It'll be great fun. Stick around. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 92.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, we're back in action. Welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. Dave Littlejohn joining me in studio as always.
Matt Dixon, where'd we leave him off, David?
With a cliffhanger.
Yep.
Guys, we are talking today about how investors sometimes get kind of narrow-minded on stuff. Maybe they have unreasonable expectations, but mostly it's around the concept of how parameters can either challenge or sometimes help investors.
Right.
But one of the things we were really talking about as we're leading into this segment is that we often have biases, these things that we carry with us, prejudgments of things in our lives, and it makes it can inform investment decisions that are not always accurate. And I told Matt, hey, I got an example.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I got an example here of something that is normal but wrong.
Okay. And I'm going to do my best to argue against it.
Here's the normal but wrong.
Okay.
The example takes place at a blackjack table where you show up, you play the first hand, and right out of the gate, you hit blackjack. And you are up 150% on your first bet.
Okay.
And you turn around and you play the next hand. And you lose. And you say, well, it's okay because I was playing with the house's money. Okay? And that is wrong.
I was going to do my best to argue against it. However, I cannot because that was your money.
Correct. Once you won, that previous hand was over. The money is now in your possession legally. You could get up from the table and walk away. What you did was you mentally reframed it in order to justify the next bet. And when you lost, in order to not feel the pain the same way, you rationalized it by saying it was never your money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That is a very normal thing to do, but it is inaccurate.
Yeah,
it is totally your money. And so that's the issue here, is that reframing issue in order to rationalize something. OK, that is a super normal thing that, you know, how many times have you ever misplaced your keys and then started shouting around like, who moved my keys? Only to discover they were in your pocket or something stupid. And you realized all along, nobody else did it. It was you.
Mm-hmm.
OK. But who wants to feel that stupidity move, right?
Right.
No, I'm going to assume somebody else caused this problem. I would never do it. Okay. Those are normal, but they're inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so if you were to take some of that, you talked about something that is, you know, what happens when somebody buys something and they just won't.
Well, yeah, you had said the buy and hold Tesla till infinity person, right?
Yes.
And
so what's going on there?
Well, the reality is, like, I think that's a false idea that you can just hold on to something and you're guaranteed to be okay, right?
Uh-huh.
Because people will tell me that. Well, I've owned this for 30 years and it's been a darling, so I'm fine. But I think you need to look back at history and say, you know, that's not always been the case. Like back in the 1970s, there was a group of like 50 stocks. I think they called it the Nifty 50 or something. Mm-hmm. And everyone's like, they're, you know, here to stay. Just hold those forever and you'll be fine. But like, let's talk about the fact that half of those stocks delisted, disappeared. The companies are gone. They're not even here today. Right. And so it's like, just because, like, for example, Apple, just because Apple is a company today, that doesn't necessarily mean that Apple will be a company 50 years from now. So for the person who's 20, 30 years old and they're like, I'm just going to buy Apple, hold it forever and everything will be fine. I'm like, like I kind of got a little bit of an issue with that because that's not a foolproof plan, right? Like Apple could no longer be the favorite cell phone of consumers. That's possible. And they don't have a lot of other products. Like, they could go away. Like, you could make an argument for that. Mm-hmm. So just because it's the biggest, you know, dog in the cage today doesn't mean it's going to be the biggest dog in the cage tomorrow.
It kind of fits in something that we would call overconfidence bias. There's mm-hmm. a bunch of these, by the way.
And oh, I bet.
Probably invent some and you wouldn't know the difference, right? But overconfidence bias is the idea that somebody, they really feel like they know something.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same way as like somebody that feels like they're luckier than somebody else, right?
Mm.
Okay, like overconfidence bias is the reason people play the lottery. Somebody's got to win, and I think my odds are actually better than zero. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to play it, right?
Yeah.
It's a subtle, but it's a real thing. It's overconfidence. But we see this also. There's another version of this called the Dunning-Kruger effect, where the less you know about something, the more confident you are.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you become an expert, the less confident you are, when it's ironically you actually are the expert and should know it. But it's like, well, I know everything, and now I know that I don't know anything, right?
Right. That's how I feel about the government, right? Like, when you're the more you start to learn about how complex that system is, the more you realize, like, I know nothing.
It's over the last 10 years of me doing this show, that has kind of been the pathway that I've had to go on. Is I've been forced into a less partisan position because it's just complicated. Not everything is, right? But
sure.
to say, like, well, you know, brand
it's
X caused
this. It's easy to fix
this.
It by just doing that.
Yeah. You know, if we just elect this different person that will solve everything, it will all be – no.
Yeah.
No, it's a super complicated and irritatingly slow and system.
Well, and then there's the person that's like, well, if we just did this, it would solve the entire issue. And it's like, well, we don't know what the domino effect of that is on other things.
Sometimes if we just did this, it's really terrifying. Like, if we just eliminated every person that disagreed with me, you're like, whew, okay.
And you do have those people.
That you do? And I'm like, glad you're not in charge.
Yeah.
Right? You know, like, that's pretty heavy-handed.
Yeah.
So, you know, what if somebody wanted to change their mind? Too late now, right? So anyway, yeah, the overconfidence bias is a biggie. It's this idea that folks will be able to somehow outperform the odds. The confirmation bias is a big one, right? The idea that, hey, I believe in something, so I only look for the data that affirms what I believe, and I disregard the things that disagree with it.
One of the other big pieces, I think, because the show's really talking about, like, are you a narrow-minded investor, right?
Yes.
There are some people that have this belief that if I just have enough money, all the problems will be solved, right?
Oh, man.
And you see it in, like, pro athletes, right? Like, they have a massive amount of talent. They go get $300 million contracts, and they end up broke and homeless, right? Like Delonte West, look at him, right? Played with LeBron James, won championships. The guy's homeless today. He has nothing.
Yeah.
So you look at this and you're like...
Because playing basketball is not the skill of making money.
No.
Playing basketball was the skill. Making money is what happened because the skill existed. But the skill of managing the money was never learned in that scenario.
One of the richest athletes, like... ever. I forget his name, but he didn't even make very much money in the NBA, but he was brilliant, just absolutely brilliant when it came to business investing. And he took all of his earnings and he just invested in really, really smart ways and became a billionaire. Right.
Hmm.
And so it's like, and I think he actually just recently passed away last month, but, the guy was really, really good. He had a lot of skills. He was a good networker. Mm-hmm. He had a lot of good relationships. And so I think...
And some startup capital.
And some startup capital,
and
right?
And let's not forget, sometimes you have to be in the right place at the right
sure.
time. So that's the other thing, is this idea that sometimes folks think that survival bias is talent, right?
Mm.
Elon Musk might be an example of that. He's doubled down multiple times in a row and ended up at the top of the food chain. But could that happen again? If he were in a different place in a different time, could he redo it?
Yeah.
And when people say, like, oh, sure. I'm like, well, look, in order to access what he did, he needed to be in Silicon Valley at a time when online payments and PayPal was just blowing up. And when you had sort of the like investor capital groups were just starting to form, and you were starting to see this private equity stuff showing up and throwing mm-hmm. money at projects for young entrepreneurs. Like, all those things had to be in place. I mean, if he'd been in, I don't know, like Utah, they yeah. probably would have never been in a circumstance for that to occur.
Right.
Right. No, not knocking Utah when I say that. I'm just like threw out a random state that doesn't have the same population center. Right. Mm-hmm. And was not the epicenter of financial activity.
Right.
Right. I mean, South Carolina, we could have said that, right? Like, blah, blah, blah. I mean, and that doesn't mean you can't be successful there. It's just like, how do you do what Elon Musk did?
Yeah.
And so people look at him and say, clearly a genius, right? And I would suggest probably, yes, actually is a genius, but simultaneously would suggest that there's some survivorship bias in the fact that he's the one that made it. All the ones that didn't, we forgot about.
Yeah. I mean, I was watching a show recently about this guy that's like a self-made billionaire, and he didn't have a ton of startup capital even. He would just really honed in on the relationship and networking piece, and he made friends with a couple billionaires that had yachts, and he was really good at sales. And so he represented them in a few sales, and that kind of caught on. And by the time he was done, he had this, you know, multi-million dollar company that specialized in just yacht sales. Right. And he just knew all the people that had all the boats. Yeah. And so he was the broker going in between, making 5% on each boat sale. And it's mm-hmm. like, oh, now you're a billionaire, too, and you can buy your own yacht. And he didn't have a ton of startup capital, but he networked well.
Yeah. Well, and so, I remember the joke is like if everybody's ever heard about what the oldest profession is. Right?
Sales.
Yeah. Because it turns out it was still sales. Right?
Yes.
It's like the oldest profession, and the second oldest profession is sales, which, strangely enough, resembles the first.
Yes, and so, if you don't know that joke, I'm sure you can Google it.
So. Exactly. You'll figure it out. So I want to talk about in the last segment, because you brought this up, the concept. We're going to, by the way, we're totally cliffhangering you on this because it's important, and I don't want you to go away. So we're going to have to take our last break, but we're going to talk when we come back about the concept of second level thinking.
Perfect. Let's do
right?
this.
So you hear the music. That means stick around. After we take the profits for the station, then we're going to try to help you make profits by understanding
let's do it.
Second level thinking. Stick around. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
Yeah, True Wealth. On News Radio, 93.9 FM at 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, home stretch of the True Wealth Show. We got to get into this fast. Matt,
yep.
Fix our brain.
Well, I don't know that I can
yeah,
fix
it. It's too
it.
Late. Save yourself.
Yeah, run. but what I think we can do is just reshape the way that you approach investing, right? Like, I think that's the goal of this show. Don't be narrow-minded. Have a little bit broader view of how this thing actually works.
Being open-minded?
Broad, open, yeah.
We'll go with that,
yeah.
Sure.
But, okay, so there's this concept, right? And it's titled or called second-level thinking, right? And it's kind of a more experienced investor idea. So maybe this isn't for the beginner, but for the more seasoned investor, try and grasp this. So, we can look at companies, right? And we tend to do this and we'll just be like, well, the company X is undervalued, right? And however you came to that determination, that's up to you. But you can look at something and say, well, it's undervalued, and then you go and you just buy it, right? But I think what I'm trying to challenge people to do is to look another step further into what's the market maybe not fully understanding in the moment. And it's this idea of looking forward and not just looking back, right? Mm-hmm. Like, because we tend to look back at a company and say, oh, you know, based on their sales, this, that, or the other, it looks like it's a little undervalued. Let's just buy it. But we don't take the next step into, well, where is the market headed? And
I'm going to quote a really famous non-investor.
Okay.
On this one. When asked how he became the great one, one of his responses was, I skate to where the puck is going.
Mm-hmm.
Wayne Gretzky, ladies and gentlemen.
One of my favorite
quotes as, you know, skate to where the puck is going. And so it sounds like what you're suggesting is if you want to have an understanding of where these and what this investment may be valued at, you need to sort of have a vision for the future and what may come of it.
Mm-hmm.
And is it not being reflected in the price?
Yeah.
Right. There is an element of like gypsy crystal ball reading to this.
Do you want to know why I started to sour on the markets a couple months ago?
Yes.
I mean, you can probably recall I started getting a little leery and a little like, it was because everyone that I was listening to was saying, well, Trump got elected and he's just going to make this economy roar. And I'm like, everyone is saying the same thing. And it started to spook me. So I think that's one of the frame ups here. If everyone's bullish, ask yourself, why might they be wrong?
Yeah. By the way, this is, there is an indicator for this.
Okay.
Sentiment indicator.
Mm, yeah.
And so what happens is when the sentiment indicator gets too bullish, it's actually a contrarian indicator.
Right. Like if everyone's saying buy,
right.
there's a big hedge fund manager that's like, I'll take those profits.
It's my joke about the shoeshine guy, right? By the time everybody knows, like if everybody's on board, the lemmings are jumping off the cliff.
Yep.
So, yeah. And the first person to text me and says, you know, the lemmings don't really do that. I go, prove it.
I love that. Oh, man.
Yeah. So I think it's very relevant. There's a couple things here. The market is trying to always price in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Here's another really interesting thing that makes this harder, not easier, by the way. Largely speaking, you know, the major indexes are down over the last 2-3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
The Magnificent Seven have become instead of the Mag Seven, they're the Lag Seven right now. Most of them are off by 20% or more. Only a handful, like I think Apple's down 18% or something.
Yeah.
But 20% would be considered a bear market correction.
Mm-hmm.
A 20% pullback is a bear market. And so the seven largest stocks in the S&P 500 have all experienced that. And so then the question is, well, are they going to get much, much worse? And everybody says, well, what about the tariffs or this, that, and the other? To which I would say, do you think they are unaware of the tariffs?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Do you think that, you know, Apple is out there going like, oh my goodness, there's tariffs? I had no idea. Right? It's kind of silly when you hear me say it that way. We're like, well, no, duh. Of course they know about it. But do you think investors at an institutional level already factoring that in? Do you think they're just waiting to be like, well, I wonder what CNN's going to say? I mean, do you think that's what's going on? Because I don't. I think that they have professional analysts that are already, you know, looking through the documents coming out of the White House. They're listening to what was already said, and they're running hypothetical models to suggest, well, if the tariffs come in at these levels, this is what we would anticipate the effect to be. And if they come in at a different level, this is what we anticipate. And they've already set these things up in spreadsheets and software so that they can adapt the variables and quickly see what the value implied would become.
If there are billions and billions and billions of dollars at stake, and the outcome is billions and billions of dollars, don't you think that they're running the numbers and looking into the future?
Right. Now, I do think that it's not because everybody in the room is smarter. That's not what I think is going on. I don't think all the analysts are smarter than you. But I do think that they have resources at their disposal that you do not. And they oftentimes have more specialized information than you. And so their ability to divine or discern what is coming out of that is higher oftentimes because they have more information resources than you.
Right. I think that's the big takeaway here. It's just like play where the market isn't looking, right? Not where it already is.
Yeah.
Like if it is a tech bubble, you know, and
or look further out, because I think most of the time the market's pricing 3 to 6 months out. So you need to say, well, I may not be able to be competitive in a 3 to 6 month time horizon, which means I need to take a 2 to 3 year time horizon. And incidentally, you know who does that very well? Warren Buffett.
Yeah.
He says, I'm not terribly concerned about this. I'm buying future earnings for the company, and future earnings isn't next month or next quarter.
Right.
Right. He's saying this is something that we can get behind for the next several years.
Mm-hmm.
And when he does, they buy large stakes in the company, oftentimes controlling stakes where they can also have influence over how the company behaves.
Right.
But nevertheless, I think that is very relevant as you think about how might you be an investor, because we get sucked into trading, right? Reason I asked you the question, Matt, like, what's the time horizon? And you're like, oh, 1 to 2 years, right? And I would suggest that's very difficult for our listeners to use that time horizon to make investment decisions.
It is.
Because you're competing with super high power tech companies that have, they have access to resources that you cannot have, right? Dark pools and high frequency trading and things where we legislatively made exceptions that it would be considered breaking the law if you did some of the things that they did.
Right.
Okay. But those things become rounding errors over the course of 2 or 3 years, but not over 2 or 3 weeks. So we adjust our time horizons. This is about parameters that are forced upon you.
Right? Yeah.
And so successful investors tend to be good at looking at the direction of major trends and being there. Right.
Yep.
And the crazy thing is we are immune to nothing. There are no safe companies anymore. If you don't believe me, go look at Tesla. It was the darling 5 years ago. It's the darling probably 2 years ago. And today it is in the crosshairs.
Yeah.
Okay. And tomorrow it may be the darling again. Who knows?
Yeah.
Right.
That's why you got to have conviction.
5 years from now, I suspect it's still around.
Right.
I'm not making recommendations when I say this. Right. I'm just telling you, think longer term than weeks and months. And I think it will be an easier challenge to overcome than thinking, you know, weeks or months or maybe quarters.
Right.
So anyway, Matt, for those of those out there that are just like going, this is just too much, I don't want to do the thinking, can you help?
Yeah.
How do they reach us?
Why don't you go to the website at littlejohnfs.com and just send us a quick chat or an email. Or you can give us a phone call at 541-375-0898, or you can even text that number.
All right.
Lots of ways.
Lots of ways. Well, that's the music, so I guess it is time. Hey, good show, man. Thanks for helping our listeners here, and hopefully you guys took some value. Like I said, if you do not have somebody in your life, you can give us a call.